Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. My guest today is Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a distinguished law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. She's also president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's been a criminal defense attorney at the trial and appellate levels. She's a noted author. She writes numerous articles on topics we should all know about, and we can learn about them by reading what Marjorie has to say. Oh, they're posted in professional journals, published in professional journals and on many websites, including Global Research. And they're all on Marjorie's blog, which is Marjorie Cohn, C-O-H-N.com. Also information about her books. Three on the site. Oh, one I've read, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Very sadly, the Obama gang seems to be doing it the same way. And Marjorie has a new book out that we want to talk about today and a couple of other topics. Her new book is called Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. The law is the law, and nobody is exempt, from the lowliest private to the President of the United States. That's the way it is. There are no exceptions. Oh, we want to get into a couple of other things, at least a little bit briefly. Marjorie, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Steve.
Oh, it's delightful having you back. And if we don't get enough done today, I know you can only stay for 30 minutes. If we don't get enough today, then I'll just have to have you back and we'll continue because everything you say is so important. Very quickly, and we get a break in about 4 minutes after, the Souter replacement, who would you like to see replace Souter on the Supreme Court bench?
Well, if I were president, if I ran the zoo, I would choose Erwin Chemerinsky. He is the dean of the University of Irvine Law School, University of California at Irvine Law School, and is one of the leading constitutional scholars. He's a brilliant mind. He's compassionate and very progressive. I don't think that he will be chosen for a number of reasons, including that he will probably be perceived as too liberal. He was hired as dean of this new law school at University of California, Irvine. Then he was unhired when one of the rich alumni complained because he had written some critical progressive op-eds. Then he was rehired. He's also a white male, and the prevailing wisdom is that Obama wants to choose a woman since Sandra Day O'Connor is no longer on the court and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not in great health. So the leading name that's been suggested is Sonia Sotomayor, who is a Puerto Rican, would be the first Latina on the court. She was a Clinton appointee. She's a judge for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and grew up in the Bronx, went to Princeton and Yale Law School, and voted to strike down a firefighter promotion test, because no African Americans qualified, and that case is now pending before the Supreme Court. I am not well familiar with her work, but I know that she has incurred the wrath of the right wing. Jeffrey Rosen in the New Republic has smeared her intellect and character based almost exclusively on anonymous gossipy sources. He claimed that one of her opinions had an unusual footnote and evidently told some untruths about it. According to Glenn Greenwald, who is a leading constitutional law scholar and writes for Salon.com, he appeared before her and found her to be extremely perceptive, smart, shrewd, and intellectually insightful. So we'll see what happens.
You're about to break away for a commercial. Let's do that. We'll come back. We'll pick up with all the rest.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie, anything more you want to add on a Souter replacement that we can jump to Condi Rice and you at Stanford?
Yes. I think that whoever replaces Justice Souter should be someone who has tried cases, who has been in the trenches, who understands the problems of real people. And one of the things I like about Erwin Chemerinsky is that he's handled a number of cases. He's handled the Guantanamo cases. He represented a man named Mr. Andrade, who is serving 50 years to life for taking two videotapes from Kmart under the three strikes law. And I just hope that whoever he chooses has not spent his or her life in the ivory tower and really understands what it is to mete out justice and be on, and serve on the highest court in the land.
Oh, he sounds good to me. I would tell you, if I were president of the United States, I would choose either you, Francis Boyle, Michael Ratner, and those are the three names that pop most prominently into my mind. But neither you or I are President Marjorie, so we can only go with what they do to us, not for us, unfortunately. I watched your YouTube performance this morning at Stanford. Oh, you were glorious. You were absolutely glorious. Listeners can go to your blog, MarjorieCohn.com. Again, they can find all your articles, your books, and they can watch you on YouTube. And you were indeed splendid. What can I say? Condi Rice, torture, she's on the faculty. You are a Stanford grad, and you nailed a notice to the president's door saying that people who commit war crimes should be prosecuted, should be held to account, and they should not be on the Stanford faculty. Talk about that a bit.
Yes, there was a reunion of about 150 anti-war activists from the 60s. It was our 40th anniversary reunion of the what we call the April 3rd movement, because on April 3rd, 1969, hundreds of Stanford students made a decision to have a sit-in in the Applied Electronics Laboratory, which was conducting chemical and biological warfare research for use in the Vietnam War and secret research. And we had a 9-day sit-in, and we actually succeeded in getting the research banned from campus. the movement went on, and we had a number of other actions. There was tremendous, of course, Stanford students did all kinds of research, power structure research, the interlocking directorates between the trustees and the defense contractors. And every 10 years, we have a reunion. And our reunion this year coincided with an action by the Stanford students, and they're called Stanford Says No to War. And I just want to say one more word about the reunion, and then I'll talk about the Condoleezza Rice action. The reunion featured panels on foreign policy, the economy, political and social movements, science and technology, media, energy and the environment, and strategies for aging activists. And so it was quite a stimulating, intense, wonderful reunion. The petition that the Stanford students say no to war, it's actually Stanford Says No to War, but it's a student organization run by current Stanford activists, says that Condoleezza Rice should be held accountable for any serious violations of the law through investigation and, if the facts warrant, prosecution. And then I participated in nailing that petition to the door of the president's office, and by so doing, we were telling Stanford that the university should not have war criminals on its faculty because there's prima facie evidence that Condoleezza Rice approved torture and misled the country into the Iraq War, and Stanford has an obligation to investigate those charges. And I should say that in October of 1968, Stanford anti-war activists had nailed a document to the door of the trustees' office, which demanded that Stanford halt all military and economic projects concerned with Southeast Asia. So it was reminiscent of the action 41 years ago.
The Hoover Institution is at Stanford, is it not?
It is indeed, and that's where Condoleezza Rice is. She is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. It's a right-wing think tank, and she is also a tenured political science professor. And it is our contention that this is not a question of academic freedom. Academic freedom protects a professor's right to espouse radical views in the classroom and in scholarly articles, but it does not protect someone who has been hired by the administration to advise it on how to commit war crimes and get away with it. That crosses the line and does not constitute academic freedom. And when she was National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice authorized waterboarding in July of 2002, according to a newly released report of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And then less than 2 months later, she participated in the Bush administration's campaign to sell the Iraq war to the American people using lies and misrepresentation, in spite of the UN International Atomic Energy Agency's assurances that Saddam Hussein did not possess nuclear weapons. In September of 2002, Condoleezza Rice said, "We don't want the smoking gun to become a mushroom cloud." So her participation in hyping what became an illegal war in Iraq and her participation in setting the policy that led, authorized, and led to the torture and abuse of prisoners constitutes war crimes, and she should be investigated and prosecuted.
Oh, indeed, Maggie, that horrible line that she used, I've quoted her on that, and also the line when the conflict in Iraq was really, really getting out of control, her line something to the effect that a democracy is messy. Messy.
Yes.
Well, war crimes are messy. There's no democracy. There's no intent to establish democracy. There's intent to establish hardline authoritarian rule.
Let me also say that if you go on to my blog, MarjorieCohn.com, and you read the posting, my posting that I posted, I think it was last night, which has the YouTube clip from the Stanford nailing the petition on the door. If you read down a little further, actually the second posting, and it's also referred to in the most recent posting, is a 7-minute clip from Condoleezza Rice in an informal Q&A with Stanford students where they ask her, you know, they say, "Didn't you authorize waterboarding?" And she said, "I didn't authorize anything. I conveyed the authorization of the administration to the agency." That was the CIA. And then they asked, "Well, isn't waterboarding illegal?" And this is what she said. "By definition, if it was authorized by the president, it did not violate our obligations under the Convention Against Torture." And, of course, that's very much like Nixon's statement, "When the president does it, that means it's not illegal." So we got a real bird's-eye view into her view of executive power, which is basically a throw out the checks and balances, throw out the legislative and judicial branches. The president, if the president says so, it doesn't violate the law.
Oh, this idea that Bush claimed himself to be a unitary president. Is that the right term? I haven't used it in a while.
It's unitary executive, but yes.
Unitary executive.
Yes.
Such rubbish. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that.
Right.
And as you've written, and you as a scholar, as a law professor, me as an ordinary citizen turned writer, nobody is exempt from the law. It doesn't matter whether it's just any common individual on the street, or the head of the most powerful country in the world, nobody is exempt under any conditions for any reason ever.
That's true, and Obama has been resisting investigations and prosecutions.
Oh, has he ever?
He says we want to look forward, not backward, and you can't look forward without taking care of what happened in the past and bringing people to account. He wants to be bipartisan. He doesn't want to alienate the Republicans. He doesn't want to be perceived as going on a witch hunt. But this is not a witch hunt. This is not going after someone for lying about sex. This is investigating and prosecuting people who committed war crimes. And under the U.S. War Crimes Act, torture is considered to be a war crime. Obama, when he swore to uphold the Constitution, he swore to faithfully see that the laws are faithfully executed, and that means prosecuting people where there's probable cause to believe that they've committed crimes. So I don't think he's going to be able to resist and force his attorney general, if indeed he is, and I know the attorney general, he has said that it's up to Eric Holder, but I'm sure that Eric Holder is going to carry out Obama's political agenda. I think that as these torture memos come out, as the congressional reports come out, as whistleblowers come out and talk about what they did and what happened, it will become increasingly difficult to ignore. And quite frankly, if the United States does not investigate and prosecute the high Bush officials and their lawyers, and that includes John Yoo, Jay Bybee, David Addington, William Haynes, Stephen Bradbury, then other countries will. And Spain right now is investigating the Bush administration for its torture policy and Iraq, I believe. and this is under the very well-established principle of universal jurisdiction, which says that certain crimes are so atrocious, they're crimes against all of humanity, and any country can punish foreign nationals who committed war crimes, etc. That Israel used universal jurisdiction to prosecute, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust. The United States used universal jurisdiction to try, convict, and sentence Chucky Taylor of Liberia to 97 years in January. A Miami federal court did that for torture that took place in Liberia. So there's one easy way to make that Spanish investigation go away, and that is for the United States to take care of business and investigate and prosecute these people. That Spanish lawsuit would evaporate immediately.
Oh, indeed. And the only way to prevent future crimes, Maju, you know it so well, I know it so well as well, is to go after the people who did it, prosecute them, hold them to account, convict the guilty, punish them severely for the crimes they committed, and that's the deterrent to prevent future people from doing it. They will know that if they do it, they too may be prosecuted, and that's something to think about when you go to bed at night. Oh, we have one more segment before you have to leave.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Audrey, back again to the bottom of the hour when we break again and you have to run. Let's talk about your book, and I'll continue it in the second half of the program. Your new book called Rules of Engagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Let me just read one thing that I wrote in an old article. I quoted, there's so much international and U.S. law on this about war crimes, torture, and the rest. I quoted, from a number of them, but one from the U.S. Army Field Manual, 2710, paragraph 498 states that any person, military or civilian, who commits a crime under international law is responsible for it and may be punished. And that means anybody. So you wrote about the honor of military people dissenting and not committing crimes.
Yes, and I just wanted to correct one thing, Steve. It's rules of disengagement.
Oh, disengagement, I'm sorry.
Yes, and people do make that mistake. They talk about rules of engagement because the title is a takeoff on rules of engagement.
I read it wrong. Please forgive me.
No, that's okay. Rules of engagement limit the forms of combat, the levels of force, and legitimate enemy targets. They define what's legal in warfare and what is not. And the rules of engagement are defined by international law and U.S. law in the present. The book actually goes back and forth from the Vietnam War to the current Iraq and Afghanistan wars and talks about parallels. One of those parallels is the rules of engagement. During Vietnam, they had free fire zones where the soldiers were allowed to shoot at anything that moved. And there are testimonies in our new book, and I co-authored it with Kathleen Gilbert, who's a national expert on military administrative law and the co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Military Law Project. Military Law Task Force. and the rules of engagement today are very similar. Shoot at what moves, and this was true in Fallujah, where in retaliation for the deaths of four mercenaries, the deaths and mutilation of four Blackwater mercenaries, the U.S. military went in and killed between 4,000 and 6,000 civilians. And there were many independent journalist accounts of firing on people as they were running, firing on families, firing on people who had been wounded and were lying down. But the book talks about, it begins with a contrast between the GI movement in Vietnam and the GI movement today, and the similarities between the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the war in Vietnam are striking. All illegal wars, all violate the UN Charter because none of them were prosecuted in self-defense or with the blessing of the Security Council. And let me just say a word here about the war in Afghanistan, because many people think that's the right war, that, well, we should get out of Iraq because it's a mistake, although it's also illegal. But the war in Afghanistan is also illegal. The UN Charter is a treaty we've ratified and part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And the UN Charter says that no country can invade another unless it's acting in self-defense or with the permission of the Security Council. The Security Council did not authorize either the Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan wars, and neither of the three were done in self-defense. We know that Vietnam was started on a lie, the Gulf of Tonkin, which was manufactured. Iraq, there were no weapons of mass destruction, and they knew it. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban never attacked us. It was 15 men from Saudi Arabia, 15 out of the 19 individuals. And when the Bush administration said to the Taliban, turn over Osama bin Laden, you're harboring a terrorist, or we will attack you, and they didn't turn over Osama bin Laden, we went in and attacked Afghanistan. Now, let's say in 1979, after the vicious, tyrannical, torturing Shah of Iran had been overthrown in a revolution, and he came to the United States and was given asylum, which really did happen. Let's say that the new government of Iran had come to the United States and said, turn over the Shah to us, give him to us, he's a terrorist, he's a torturer, we're going to invade you. And let's say we didn't turn him over. Would that have been a lawful invasion? Of course not. So there are many parallels, and there are parallels with the GI movements. In the GI movement during Vietnam, which over the course of the war, more than 500,000 soldiers deserted. Fraggings, which were killings of officers, occurred at the rate of at least one per week. They set up underground newspapers and coffee houses where service members met and discussed politics and resistance strategies. And the draft, of course, galvanized the anti-war movement among college students. The rebellion in the Army became so strong that the Pentagon had to shift its strategy from ground combat to an air war over Indochina. And African American and white soldiers began to discuss the links between racism at home and racism used to instill hatred of the Vietnamese people. And likewise, women in the military and their civilian supporters began to explore the ways in which sexism was used to train and motivate soldiers, bringing to light serious problems of sexual discrimination, harassment, and abuse. The end of the Vietnam War, the end of American involvement in Vietnam, was largely a result of the anti-war movement, particularly the resistance by American GIs, in addition to the resilience of the North Vietnamese. Then today, we have a whole new generation of GIs and veterans discussing the lessons from Vietnam. And resistance to the occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan are growing. There are coffee houses. People are speaking out, filing for conscientious objector status. We have a poverty draft and a backdoor draft, the stop-loss policy. All of these themes are covered in my new book, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent.
Well, I'm going to talk more about it in a second. You do have to run, right?
Yes, I do.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Oh, going solo on the second half of the program. If anybody wants to call in and make a comment, I'd be delighted to chat. Marjorie Cohn is one of the many terrific guests we have on the program, and she's been on before, and I certainly hope that I can have her come back very soon. I read and I reviewed her earlier book, Cowboy Republic. It is one terrific book. It's a short book, but it's very power-packed, covering the crimes of the Bush administration, torture, war crimes by violating U.S. international law, on the subject of can and cannot go to war. International law is very clear. Even a non-lawyer like me can read about it, understand it clearly, quote from it. I've done it numerous times. People read some of the things I write and they think I'm a lawyer. I'm not. But I can read. Thankfully, I learned that. And whether we're talking about, the UN Charter, Article 51, it's very clear on the conditions under which a nation can go to war. It can't do it because it claims is a threat, the way we did fraudulently against Afghanistan and Iraq. There was no threat. Neither country attacked us. Neither country threatened to attack us. We were the threat, and we attacked both, and we occupy both now. Article 51 of the UN Charter says something to the effect that you may attack another country if it attacks you. You can defend yourself. The sacred principle also, I think in a number of international laws, of the right to self-defense. And you can do it under Article 51 until the UN Security Council votes either to say you can continue doing what you're doing or you must cease and desist. Well, the Security Council wouldn't say, I hope it wouldn't say that you can't defend yourself. If you're attacked, you certainly have a right to defend yourself. This is what goes on in occupied Palestine all the time. Israel relentlessly attacks Palestinians. They do not initiate preemptive attacks, but they defend themselves when they are attacked. And we've discussed that many times on this program. And international law, again, is very clear. They have the right to self-defense, especially, my goodness, in their case, they have light arms, some homemade weapons against the world's fourth most powerful military, nuclear armed, also with the latest weapons and technology and munitions that they get from us. So we're complicit in their war crimes. But I know what Marjorie's new book, Rules of Disengagement, is pretty new, just out recently, and I have not had a chance to read it. But earlier I read and I wrote about and discussed on this program Francis Boyle's book, pretty much on a similar topic. His book is called Protesting Power. And again, how soldiers in the ranks, anywhere from the lowliest private to the officer corps, to the highest individuals in the officer corps, they have an obligation under U.S. law and under international law to disobey illegal orders. That's what the law says. That's what the U.S. Army Manual 2710. I read one brief part of one paragraph on what it said, but you go through our own manual, our own U.S. Army Manual, and it's very clear. It says that military forces have an obligation to disobey illegal orders. Now, if you're prosecuted for doing it and you get before a judge who respects the law, that judge is going to throw out the case and find you innocent. What's happened at least once, I think it was with Aaron Watada. My memory may be faulty. It's been a while since I've looked at that. But I believe Aaron Watada refused to obey an illegal order, and he was about to be prosecuted. And I think they took the case so far. The U.S. Government took the case so far, and they decided not to proceed further. Hope I've got the right man. I think it was him. They decided not to proceed further because they have no case. So rather than be embarrassed, they dropped the whole thing. So Watada won by default. If I'm wrong on that, and somebody knows, please correct me. But I know at least one of our service personnel ran into that situation. It is an honor to disobey an illegal order. It is an honor. It is a great dishonor to obey an illegal order. Sadly, most of the troops don't know the difference. They're in the ranks. They're told to do something, and they do it. Pretty tough for lowly enlisted people, especially newly inducted ones in a year, 2 years, whatever, and they're sent to a war zone. And the training they get is to vilify the enemy and make them out to be real, real bad guys. so that you really believe these young kids, most of them really don't know the difference, and they're taught that they're really fighting an evil force. So it's our obligation to go at this evil force and remove it, because we represent democracy and they represent anti-democratic forces. Well, of course, the truth is exactly the opposite. But what does a young kid know, 18, 19 years old? What did I know when I was that age? Not what I know now. Well, Marjorie wrote about it, and she wrote about the Bush crimes, and my goodness, I do it all the time, and so much of what I write, torture has been a very important issue for me. It's been a while since I've written about Iraq and Afghanistan, but years back, I wrote a number of articles on it and the war crimes we committed and the illegal weapons that we used, like white phosphorus, depleted uranium. What a horror those are. Depleted uranium alone. In weapons, everything from bullets to artillery shells to missiles with core depleted uranium in their tips, that when it aerializes, it contaminates everything over which it spreads, the land, the water, the air. This is nuclear radiation. It kills. And it's done horrors to the people of Iraq. It never gets reported. Cancer rate in Iraq skyrocketed after the 1990 Gulf War. And, of course, it continued because we keep using these weapons. We did the same thing in Yugoslavia, 1999, the Yugoslav War. Well, the war really began earlier. Milosevic was targeted going back, at least at the beginning of the 1990s, really, I think, at the end of the 1980s. And we wanted to dismember Yugoslavia. This was part of our imperial agenda. And then that horrible 3 months or so war that we waged in 1999, where we destroyed the country because we had broken it apart sooner, split it up. One country, we split it into pieces to make it more easily manageable. And the country, rump Yugoslavia and Kosovo, we literally destroyed it. The country was never the same these past 10 years. It's not the same now. And we do this everywhere we go, Eastern Europe, with our military bases and the nefarious things we do there. The Cold War against Russia never ended. It continued under neoliberal policies where we wrecked Russia. We wrecked the former Soviet republics, Romania, Hungary, Poland, the Baltic states. And this is what we do. I recently saw a quote by somebody who was involved in the shock therapy, the so-called shock therapy, turning Russia into a so-called free market country. Well, it was nothing of the sort. The plan was to literally prevent it from operating in a normal way. So a few oligarchs got very rich. Our Western corporations did okay, but the oligarchs took most of it for themselves. The people of Russia became deeply, deeply impoverished. I wrote about that a long time ago and then wrote about it a little bit in future articles. These were war crimes by other means, by economic means, and this is what we're doing right now. Friday on the program, we'll talk again a little bit with Michael Hudson on Iceland. We talked about it the last time he came on. They just had an election that supposedly leftist leaders won. But the election has nothing to do with left or right. The election has to do with, will Iceland claim its sovereignty and its rights and govern itself, or will it surrender to Western powers, to Western bankers, and let it be sucked into a permanent state of debt bondage? Oh, we have a caller. Well, I'll be happy to take that. Oh, come on and be happy to hear what you have to say. Go ahead. Are you on?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Oh, please go right ahead.
Yeah, you know, I love listening to you, and I enjoy hearing Petras, and who's the other gentleman you had on recently?
Oh, my goodness, so many. On Monday, what did I have on Monday? I mean, such wonderful people. Michael Parenti was on Monday.
Right. And anyway, so I get this feeling that we're still not getting the point. I mean, this whole left-right paradigm is set up by the system, and as long as we keep falling into it, we'll keep repeating the problems that they've created. I mean, I had this sort of graphically explained to me, well, not graphically, but I was at church. My church is an old lefty church from Boston, if you know the community church.
Oh, I grew up in Boston.
Yeah, so you know community church, right?
Well, it's been 50 years since I lived there, so I'm a little rusty. But I grew up in Boston in the 40s and 50s.
The progressive, the far-left progressive end of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And right around the election time, I was bad-mouthing both of the controlled candidates. And so one of our parishioners came up and said, well, where do we go from here? You know, which is the old, you know, we create the problem, you react, we'll give you our solution. You know, and that's what the game is ended up being. So when he said that, I said, okay, I'll nail this sucker to the wall. I said, I'm not interested in moving forward with this stupid program. I'm interested in going back to the Constitution. He got up and walked away.
Well, you know, we do talk about left and right, but, of course, the way our government is run here, there is no left and right. I've quoted, it's been a while, but I've quoted Gore Vidal a couple of times, who talks about the fact that we have a one-party state, and he uses either two terms to describe it. He either calls it the money party or the property party with two wings, and they get less distinguishable all the time. So we get a guy in Obama. I'm absolutely convinced that the game, the election was rigged.
Oh, yeah.
To see to it that a friendly face, an eloquent guy, somebody who looks different, talks different,
well,
but of course acts the same.
But if you understand the setup, you see,
the setup is to keep the system the same.
Right. They didn't need to rig this election, you see, because it was already rigged. You had the bad cop and the worst cop. I mean, actually, Obama's playing the good cop.
Oh, indeed. And the Republicans picked an absurd ticket. I mean, they literally picked a ticket that was chosen
ticket.
To lose, not win.
Well, you know, if you look at the bios of all of these candidates, all four of them, they were all very Israel-friendly.
Oh,
I mean,
of course.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, absolutely.
There's no way Israel could lose the election. I mean, that's a total joke.
Well, a candidate could never get into any position of power, you know, president, chairman of any of the powerful committees, speaker of the House, stuff like that, if they weren't 100% for Israel, no matter what it does.
You know,
and they all line up at the AIPAC conference, which concluded a day or so ago, and they all kiss the ring of the power of AIPAC and the power of the Israeli lobby and so on. I'm Jewish.
I know. But what I'm trying to say is, where are the anti-Zionist Jews speaking up? I don't hear them. They're
they come on this program.
Huh?
They're on this program all the time.
Right, but I mean, in general, they're kind of quiet. You see, my problem really stems because I have sort of somewhat studied World War II. Now, World War I is a little harder to pin on the Rothschild Warburgs, except that they got the Federal Reserve in 1913 and then in 1914. Okay, it's wartime. But that's a tighter, a harder one to prove. But the Second World War left no problems with proving who the collaborators were who created Hitler. I mean, it's clearly, you know, been the Warburgs funding both sides of the war, Paul Warburg funding the Allies, Max Warburg funding Hitler. I mean, it can't get any clearer than that. And then the Vatican had to conquer that with Mussolini. And there are pictures to this day of bishops and priests, along with Nazi leaders, giving the armed salute from the old Roman, you know, so the compact has already been explained to most people, but nobody gets it, that it's not just the Jewish Zionists alone. These donkeys, a lot of people are trying to pin the tail on one donkey, but there are a bunch of donkeys working together that we have to pin all of the tails on.
There's a lot of guilt to go around. There's no question about that. And I'm old enough to remember the stuff from years back. I remember World War II. I was a boy growing up, so I didn't really understand it then. But but I had members of my family that fought in the war. My dad was in World War One. Thankfully, he came back. But I will tell you this flat out. My knowledge of history tells me that we have been an imperial country from the very inception, beginning with George Washington. It just wasn't on the scale that it is today. But then again, from another point of view, consider the scale it was on. We started out with a couple of colonies, then we got more colonies. They weren't bequeathed to us. We had no bill of sale saying they belonged to us. They belonged to other people who lived there for thousands of years.
The other subplot is that what sparked the revolution was that the Bank of England didn't like the colonial script.
Oh, absolutely.
And
that's the key thing.
They made a pact with the other nations that were outside of the colonies that they were not going to expand. And I'm sure the colonists didn't like that because they wanted to expand. So there's all kinds of different little subplots in here. But we did actually make a break from the Bank of England. And, see, the Bank of England is the one that we have to really attack because, I mean, the whole have you read the thing on Educate Yourself, British Israelism? British?
No, I haven't. But
you know about Kenadachi's site, right?
I know the Bank of England, 1694 established, and one of the central banks that are privately owned. The Rothschilds got their hands on it, and famous Rothschild quotes said by a couple of the Rothschilds. But the quote, to the extent that
you
give me control of a nation's money, and I really don't give a damn what laws they make.
Right.
Because the king may wear the crown, but I've got the real crown.
See, that's the thing, the stuff that we're not taught in school.
We have to take a break.
Okay,
we'll be right
back. Hold on.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Thank the caller. I do want to use these last few minutes to make some comments that I never have a chance to do.
Hello?
So that the time is mine, and so I do want to do it.
Hello?
It's wonderful being able to host this program, to bring on wonderful guests to talk about such crucial topics that never get airing, are never reported right, are never reported in depth in the major media. Well, let me just tell you about the upcoming guests. I never have a chance to do that. I want to spend all my time with the guests that I have on. But tomorrow I'll have activist Mike Farrell on. On Friday, economist Michael Hudson will be back. We'll talk about the economy. On Monday, Ellen Brown will be back. We'll talk about the economy again. And her crucial new book, but it was updated at the end of last year called Web of Debt. I'm writing about it now. I put the first article out today. It's up on Global Research. An awfully important book that needs to be read. On Tuesday, Ralph Nader will be here. On Wednesday, this is next week, the co-director of the Israeli Human Rights Organization, B'Tselem, will be on. Her name is Gilles Versky. On Thursday, we'll talk about Haiti again. It's a subject that I have to go back to as often as I can, as there are things that I need to address because Haiti is an occupied country. Brian Concannon will be back. He heads a human rights organization. He's a lawyer. He's been on several times. On Friday, economist Jack Ramses will be back to talk about his latest writing and the state of the economy. And I've got more guests already scheduled for later in May and a couple already scheduled into June. And we'll continue doing what is so important. Just imagine if this kind of programming were on primetime TV every night, not just one program. What if all of the ones were like this? Or what if just a few of them were like this? But there are none of them like this. And it has nothing to do with me. I think of myself as a facilitator. It's the wonderful people that I bring on. That's the treat. That really is the treat. to have these people tell you what's really going on and the most important things. And we need to focus on it because we really are going through a terrible situation right now, whether we're talking about loss of civil liberties, what I call the global economic holocaust going on, the foreign wars, illegal, and the terrible crimes we're committing, the looting of the national wealth to give it to criminal bankers, all of these things going on. You never hear a word about it in major news reports. And you turn that stuff on, any program, it is absolutely outrageous, the kind of the rubbish they put on, the rot they put on, the lies they tell, the way they distract you, the swine flu business going on now. This was timed to change the subject. It's a complete hoax. Change the subject. Get people not thinking about the things that are bringing pain into their lives. Swine flu isn't a problem. It's a criminal government and criminal bankers. That's the problem. That's what we need to address. So we talk about it all the time. And it's a great honor for me to be able to do this. I'm just a retiree who decided to do this. And I didn't really plan it. It all happened by accident. I really appreciate you tuning in. It's wonderful that you do it. Talk about it. Spread the word to other people. We need to do things ourselves. If we don't defend ourselves, nobody will. And the only way we can bring about constructive change for the better is for us to take the bull by the horns and do it. Well, I spend every day trying my best, and I hope more of you will as well. It's not for anybody else. It's for us. It's for ourselves. Come back tomorrow. I look forward to having you. We'll have another good program for you. Hopefully all the ones to come. Be back then.